BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. And, for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the actor Cillian Murphy. When the nominations for the Best Actor Oscar were announced earlier this year, it was no surprise to see his name on the shortlist. He'd already won a Golden Globe for his performance in the title role of Christopher Nolan's epic drama Oppenheimer. He specialises in complex, flawed men with dubious morals. Take Thomas Shelby, the gang boss in the globally successful television series Peaky Blinders, which made him a household name. The more pressure his characters are under, it seems, the better he gets. Growing up in Cork, he wanted to be a musician, but after turning down a record deal, he was cast in a short run of Enda Walsh's frenetic play Disco Pigs and never looked back. He says, "I've always been interested in the melancholic or the ambiguous or the more transgressive. That, to me, is drama. Getting into those knotty, difficult, uncomfortable places, I find that really stimulating." Cillian Murphy, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Lauren.
It's a real pleasure to have you here today, Cillian. And we have to start with Oppenheimer, as everybody's talking about it at the minute. That performance, so much of it was about demonstrating your character's inner turmoil through the tiniest nuances, all those close-ups, you know, and all of that under the surface that was going on.
Yeah.
How do you get into the right frame of mind to show us rather than tell us what a character is feeling?
Well, I think that's always been the sort of acting that's intrigued me, is when you can see the character thinking, seeing the face as a landscape, kind of. And I knew that Chris was going to do that on this piece, and I knew the character was so much in his head that I knew it had to be an interior kind of performance and a small performance. I also knew in the back of my mind that he was shooting this mainly on IMAX camera, so that it would be shown on an 80-foot screen, so that there wasn't that much demonstrating you needed to do physically. It needed to be more how you could sort of transmit the thought process through the face and the eyes and all that. But I knew immediately that it wouldn't be an impression. That's not where my strengths lie. And I knew it would be ultimately a sort of a synthesis of the script, all of the stuff that I was absorbing of him, and then I guess you bring an element of yourself to it, and then you put it all in the mix, and it becomes Chris's version and my version of Oppenheimer.
So you're going to be on the red carpet for Oscar night. I know that's not always your comfort zone.
Yeah, I have struggled with it in the past, and you know, it's not something I'm ever totally at ease with, but I think you have to like choose to enjoy it. And I think you can do that in your brain, you know, just make that alteration. And it's easier then. And, you know, I've had my wife and my kids with me, and that's been lovely. And, yeah, you'd be an idiot not to enjoy it, you know? Just go with it. That's my attitude.
Cillian, how have you found choosing your discs today?
I sweated over it, like everybody does. I showed a couple of friends the list, and they said, "Oh, well, that's good, Cillian. There's no weird, crazy, obscure stuff on there for a change." Some of them I haven't listened to in years, and it was a joy to listen to them, and some of them I listen to all the time. So I've loved it, I have to say.
Well, let's get started. Disc number one, what are we going to hear?
Oh, yeah. So Boy in the Bubble, Paul Simon from Graceland. This was a cassette that we had in the car when we were kids. So there's four of us, and we'd be all squashed in the back. And we'll be going on camping trips to France or Ireland or wherever we'll be going. And this album, I know every single lyric from every single song. And I don't think I knew how good the album was at the time. It was just an album that was on in the car. But now I truly appreciate it.
It was a slow day, and the sun was beating on the soldiers by the side of the road. There was a bright light, a shattering of shop windows, the bomb in the baby carriage was wired to the radio. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is the long distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow-mo, the way we look to us all.
Paul Simon and The Boy in the Bubble. So, Cillian Murphy, you were born in Cork in 1976, the eldest of four, grew up listening to that track while you were, all four of you, squashed into the back of the car. What was your seating position? That can say a lot about the hierarchy.
Well, I remember one particular trip we went on to France on the ferry, and I remember we had a Nissan Bluebird, and I remember it was my mum and dad in the front, and then me and my brother and my sister in the back, and my little sister in the baby seat, and also my grandmother. I have no idea.
That's too many people for one car.
It's not possible or legal now, but we did it.
So you were the big brother of the four. Were you a classic big brother? Were you in charge? Were you the leader of the gang?
I don't know, actually. It was funny. We found some old VHS videos recently. My dad transferred them and digitized them. And it was funny just seeing all of us hanging around at Christmas time, just messing, kind of having tickle fights and stuff. Because there was no phones. There was nowhere to go. Like, nobody went for a walk. You'd be watching telly, or maybe you'd read a book, or I'd be making a sandwich. But we were just all sitting around. And it was just interesting to see that. People not lost in devices, you know.
Were you an imaginative kid?
Very much so, yeah. An awful lot of reading, an awful lot of listening to music and playing music and writing songs. And I had a little cassette recorder I would record myself on, like singing initially, and then when I was playing guitar, just writing stuff. Music was the first thing that really woke me up to the arts or to creativity.
And music was really valued at home. That was a big part of family life, I think, wasn't it? For your parents, Brendan and Mary, did they meet playing music?
They met in West Kerry at a session, a traditional Irish music session, and that became a kind of constant for us. They were both teachers. My dad was a teacher, and then he became an inspector for schools. And there was no artists to speak of in the family. They were all teachers almost exclusively on my mother's side, and then farmers on my dad's side. But when we could, we'd be going to sessions in pubs, you know, the classic Irish childhood of falling asleep under the table and a packet of crisps and tenora. And
on a pile of coats.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, got it. Was it a culturally rich household?
Yeah, there was a lot of books on the shelves, but we never went to the theatre, for example. I got a lot of education. Like, my mum was a French teacher, and then she'd teach me French at home also. And my dad was an Irish teacher, and he would also teach me Irish at home. So I'd get, you know, in school, and then I'd get grinds at home as well.
So a house of books and music. And what were you reading? What were your own passions when you started discovering them?
Honestly, it was the Famous Five and then all the talk and stuff, and then the Irish writers. Anything that was there, I kind of read.
It's time for some more music, Cillian. What are we going to hear next?
Well, I thought I should play some traditional Irish music because it was so much part of my childhood. I mean, I should say that I rejected it all when I was a teenager and wouldn't listen to it. But now I'm starting to really appreciate it again. And this particular track, my dad found this on vinyl in some secondhand shop recently and gave it to me. And I put it on the turntable, and it just sounds absolutely beautiful. So it's a piece by a piper called Seamus Ennis. It's called The Wandering Mistral.
Seamus Ennis and The Wandering Minstrel. So, Cillian Murphy, tell me a little bit more about your relationship with your dad. Did you have any shared interests while you were growing up? What did you do together?
I think we connected probably most strongly over music. When I started playing in bands and stuff, he was the dad that would drive us around and
help you set up the amps and everything.
Yeah, all of that stuff.
So it was you and your brother did that together?
Yeah, we were in a band with like neighbours and school pals, and there was a few different versions of it, but we took it very, very, very seriously.
So the final incarnation of the band was called Sons of Mr. Green Jeans, named after the Frank Zappa track. What was the music like?
There were kind of long songs with complicated middle eights and long guitar solos. And it worked very well live. Didn't work so well when we tried to do it in a studio, because, you know, you just needed that live energy of playing together. Whereas we put it to a click track, it just sounded sterile and we lost all the soul.
Tell me more about this performing live then. That was where the band really cooked and it all kind of came together. What did that feel like?
the best feeling. That sort of non-verbal communication that you have with your bandmates and with the audience when it's just something electric, something is happening in the room. It's like a tingle. It's something kind of transcendent, really. And I felt bizarrely comfortable up there for a relatively shy kid, you know? And that was what I really wanted to do. That was it. There was no other question of anything that I wanted to do. And for a while, it looked like that would work out.
Yeah. You were offered a 5-album deal, I think, by Acid Jazz.
Yes, we were. And my brother was a youngster, and I was just about to leave school, or had left, I can't recall exactly. My parents and some of the other parents just refused to allow it to happen. And they were right. You know, I wouldn't allow my kid, I think, at that age, to sign his soul away to a corporation or a version of that. So,
how did you feel about it at the time?
I don't know if I was that heartbroken. I should say I was heartbroken, but I think I just took it on the chin and just moved on. And there was a month in my life, which was July 1996, where we got offered the record deal, we turned it down. I was stupidly doing a law degree and I failed it. And I met my now wife and I got a part in Disco Pigs all within the 1 month. So that was, I think, when things clarified for me. And I thought, okay, the music, that avenue has been shut down, but this other avenue is opening up.
And how did that feel? Was it exciting?
Really, really exciting. You know, when you're a kid, you just have that confidence of youth. You just go with what's happening. So I just went down this new path.
I want to ask more about that. But first, let's hear your next piece of music, Cillian Murphy. Your third choice today. What have you got for us?
So this is a band from Cork called the Frank and Walters. They were big all around that time that I'm speaking about, around like the mid-90s. And I was obsessed with them. I used to like go into the pubs that they used to drink in Cork and hang around and try and chat to them and go to all their gigs. And we were very influenced by them as a band. And now later in my life, I've become pals with them. And it's just a cracking, cracking pop song. It's called Walter's Trip.
The Frank and Walters and Walter's Trip. Cillian Murphy, let's go back to your school days then. How do you look back at that time? Were you a good student?
I enjoyed primary school more than secondary school. You know, I was a bit of a messer. Yeah, nothing malicious, but I'd say it was a bit of a pain in the ass to teach. And I think that was probably difficult for my parents, knowing that I was that kid in the class that they had to encounter every day. And then secondary school was different. It was quite an academic school. And there wasn't that much scope for the arts there, and it was quite sporty school, and it wasn't really my thing. But luckily, I managed to find, we used to play like school concerts and things, and had a really good English teacher, Billy Wall, who's a poet and novelist, and he very much encouraged me.
I think you're still friends. What did he spot in you? Has he ever told you?
You'd have to ask him, but what he really, he knew how to bring books and plays and poems to life, because he wasn't just teaching them, he was exploring what they were about, you know, and he knew being a writer himself, and I loved it. And I remember him saying to me, you know, you should maybe think about doing something in the arts. He wasn't quite sure what, neither was I, but it was nice to have. It's always good to have one good teacher in your corner, because I know, coming from a long line of teachers, how important one good teacher is. They can make a big difference, and I think they're undervalued as a profession, but they can really set you on the right course.
I think when you were about 17, there was another mentor that came into your life who was also a big influence on you, Pat Kiernan. What impact did he have?
Well, he came in and did a drama module when I was about 17. And I knew that he had a theatre company in Cork. So then I'd see him around after that module finished. I'd see him around Cork in pubs and things. And eventually I went to see a production that he did of A Clockwork Orange in Sir Henry's nightclub in Cork City. And it absolutely blew my mind.
And this was your first theatre experience,
yes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And a fully immersive in a nightclub, Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, promenade with like banging techno and kind of dry ice and like guys with mohawks. And it was unbelievably vital and kind of dangerous. and sexy and relevant and kind of deviant. And like for a 17-year-old who'd never been to the theatre, it was absolutely mind-blowing. It was one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my life. And after that, I just pursued him and pestered him for an audition. And then when I left school, eventually they gave me an audition.
As we heard earlier, you started a law degree, and while you were at university, you joined the Drama Society. What did you love about it?
I love the camaraderie of it. I still love above all the rehearsal process. It being like a laboratory for 4 weeks where you're just in a room with the actors trying to excavate meaning from these words and then trying to get it up on its feet, and it all seems absurd and you don't have enough time and it's all going to go wrong and you're not going to know your lines in time. But then by some miracle, it actually works and it happens and the lights go down on the opening night and it works. But I've actually always preferred the process to the performance, which I know I shouldn't say, because when you get it up and it's opening night and you're in the theatre, then it's a sort of, it's about stamina and trying to keep the form of the play for like 6 weeks or 12 weeks or 18 months, whatever it is. And I find that hard.
Let's have some more music, Killian. Your fourth choice today, please. What have you got for us?
Oh, some U2. So I think I was about 10 or 11 when Joshua Tree came out. I remember myself and my brother used to have like beds side by side, and we'd put the cassette player in the middle and we'd put this on and turn the lights off. And this song would come on, Bullet the Blue Sky, and it was the first time I ever experienced fear or danger in a piece of music, particularly that spoken word piece that Bono does, you know, the I can see those fighter planes and slapping them down and a man breathes into a saxophone. I don't know what he was talking about, but it was terrifying and brilliant.
U2 and Bullet the Blue Sky. Killian Murphy, as you said, you got the part of Pig in Ender Walsh's play Disco Pigs, which was directed by Pat Kiernan. Now, you hadn't been to drama school, you'd never acted professionally. How did you get the role?
Well, as I said, I'd been pursuing Pat Kiernan around Cork City, and Pat eventually said, all right, leave me alone, I'll give you an audition. And he happened to be away, so I met Enda in Cork, and I read a scene for him. And I went off hitchhiking to France, I remember. And then I got the part, and they sent the script to my tent, which I didn't know you could do, but they sent it to my tent in France. So then I had the part, and we toured that play for 18 months. And yeah, it was like we were just so young and cocky, and the play was only an hour long. So we put it on at like 11 or 12 at night. So it felt like that kind of nightclubby thing. So we do the play and then we just go out and go drinking and go to clubs and be messing. And it was a great thing to do at 19, 20, just to be in a successful show. You know, I was so jammy. But then eventually has to stop. And it did stop. Then I didn't work for a year and was signing on. And that was a kind of a bit of a shock. But again, you're so young, you don't mind, you just keep going.
And you then, following that experience, had small theatre parts and parts in films over the next few years. I wonder where your heart lies. Is it on stage or on set?
I don't think I could have walked onto a film set at 20 years of age with no experience whatsoever. I think I needed to do all those hours on stage.
Do you get nervous?
Not on stage. I get nervous doing films. The distinction being that I think when you do a play, you retain control insofar as if it's a terrible night and you're off, you know that tomorrow you can fix it and be better. Whereas if you commit something to celluloid, it's there forever. There's no fixing it. Mm-hmm. You may have several goes, but I found the whole sort of apparatus of filmmaking, you know, the huge lights and the vans and the trucks and the electricians and all the crew and everything, they would come to a complete stop and complete silence. And then you're supposed to perform. I found that very, very intimidating when I was a younger actor. I think I've made my peace with it now, but it was a lot to take on.
It's time for your next piece of music, Killian Murphy, number 5 on your Desert Island Discs today. What are we going to hear and why?
I went through a big Queen phase again in the 80s. This particular song has always been one of my huge favourites. And I do listen to this quite often. I just adore everything about this song.
When do you put it on?
A lot, like when I'm driving, or like if we have people around in the house, or just to feel good. It just makes me feel good.
I have spent all my years in believing you, but I just can't get no relief, Lord. Somebody. Can anybody find me? Somebody to love. I work. He works hard. Every day of my life. I work till I.
Queen and Somebody to Love. Cillian Murphy, in 2005, you were cast as Dr. Jonathan Crane, Scarecrow, in Christopher Nolan's film Batman Begins. And that was the beginning of a continuing collaboration between the two of you. What's the essence of your relationship?
We don't hang out and go bowling or whatever. You know, like we're, like, you know, we are very close colleagues. And it's a lovely feeling to walk onto a set and to feel safe and to also, most importantly, to be able to make an idiot of yourself, to be able to fail, to be able to get it wrong.
To try stuff.
Yeah. And I've always had that with him. I've always felt that with him. And it's just a gift.
I think in the past you have been quite persistent when you've gone after a part. And that's partly how you got to play Kit and Braden in Neil Jordan's film Breakfast on Pluto, wasn't it? You auditioned in 2001, but kept going back to him until 2005 when he finally got the funding to make it and he was able to offer you the part.
Yeah, I pestered him as well. wore him down. And I believe I might have written him a letter. I was a big advocate for letter writing in the early days. I met a director recently and she said, "Do you know you wrote me a letter 25 years ago?" And I do think that's appreciated. And I would say that to younger actors to actually take the time to handwrite a letter and post it because no one gets them anymore. And they're such special things to get. And I think you have to go after stuff. If you really, really think you're the right actor for it, you need to chase it down.
2006, you shot Ken Loach's film, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, and that went on to win the Palme d'Or. Now, he has said that the key to your performance in that film was that you allowed yourself to be vulnerable. And I wonder what you remember about your approach to that role.
I think you have to be vulnerable. I think it's one of the most powerful tools you have as an actor, vulnerability and empathy. And the way Ken works, which is so unusual, is that you don't get a script. You shoot everything chronologically, but the events happen in real time to the character and to the actor. So you're reacting in a completely instinctual, non-intellectual way. And it changed the way I approach work profoundly, making that film. In the story, there was a sort of a traitor in the flying column. We didn't know this, but at the beginning, he paired me with this youngster and he had me working very closely with this youngster. We went to like boot camp and like an army training and all that stuff. And he's this great little kid. He was a non-professional actor, someone that Ken found in Cork. Great little personality. And so we really got on and we were really tight. And then turns out later in the movie that he's the traitor and he's the kid that I have to, that my character has to shoot. But Ken orchestrated it in such a way that it was being more than him turning up and us looking at the sides going, "I'm going to shoot you today." It was like, it was really, I couldn't believe it when I found out. Like I was devastated. And that's just genius, you know, to make that happen. So therefore, when it happened on screen, all of what I was feeling was real, you know.
It's time for your sixth disc, Cillian. What have you chosen?
So this is a track from Radiohead and it's called Everything in Its Right Place. And this particular tune was revolutionary for me when I heard it. And, you know, they had just made OK Computer and toured around and it was the, you know, biggest album and they were the biggest band. And then they said, "No, we're actually going to do this." And I find it very, very inspiring that they went, "No, we're not going to do what you think we're going to do. We're going to do what we think we should do." And they put out this album. I think sometimes more than my acting colleagues or acting heroes, sometimes musicians, their courage in the face of the industry or the decisions they make. I mean, people like John Lennon or Sinead O'Connor or, you know, Radiohead, people like that make you brave. And they've always made me braver, I think.
Been on.
Radiohead and Everything in Its Right Place. In 2013, you took on a role that was going to flex every dramatic and other muscle that you had, Tommy Shelby, in the BBC drama Peaky Blinders. How did you persuade the writer, Stephen Knight, that you were the right person?
I mean, I wasn't the obvious choice physically, and I hadn't up to that point played, I think, anyone who had that sort of physical presence. I don't know if I convinced him in the meeting, but I don't know if this is apocryphal or he's just made it up because it's a good story. But apparently afterwards, I sent him a text saying, "Remember, Steve, I'm an actor." And I do believe that. I do think it's our duty as actors to transform to whatever the part demands. And he was generous enough to give me a go.
And I'm sure it helped being part of such a brilliant cast, one of whom I have to ask you about. Just before you started filming the final series in 2021, your co-star, Helen McCrory, who played the formidable Aunt Polly, died of cancer. What do you remember about that time? Because you and Helen had met before Peaky Blinders ever began, I think.
Yeah, we met, well, my goodness, like back in the 90s, I auditioned for her, I remember. And I even remember then she was just brilliant. Yeah, she kind of brightened up every, you know, she would make any, we were like a lot of the time shooting in like fields or, you know, in some like bog somewhere. But Helen was always funny and always brightened up every set. I loved her. And I still really miss her, you know.
Of course, you know, the series ended and you'd spent 10 years in the role. How did it feel to leave it and say goodbye?
Actually, to be totally honest with you, it was a little bit of a relief at that point. I was ready to take a little break. I felt like we'd done such excellent work and I really loved the ambiguity of the ending. It was good time to have a little respite from it. I think we all needed a break from each other, you know.
Well, speaking of what comes next, you know, everybody's talking about the Peaky Blinders movie. Would you be up for it?
Totally. I mean, I've always said that if there is more story to tell, and if Steve Knight delivers a script that I know he can deliver because he's such a phenomenal writer, I'll be there. I mean, if we want to watch like 50-year-old Tommy Shelby,
definitely.
Let's do it.
It's time to hear your seventh disc, Cillian Murphy. What's coming up next?
The Beatles are my kind of musical touchstone. I think they probably represent, in my mind, one of the greatest artistic achievements of the 20th century for me personally, not just in musically, but in terms of their humour and their sort of friendship and their tolerance. And I love this song. I love the energy of it. I love Paul's hope and optimism and then John's kind of acerbic sort of realist middle age that he gives us. It's just perfection. It's we can work it out.
Think of what you're saying. You can get it wrong and still you think that it's all right. Think of what I'm saying. We can work it out and get it straight or say goodnight. We can work it out. We can work it out. Life is very short and there's no time for fussing and fighting, my friend.
The Beatles and We Can Work It Out. Cillian Murphy, I wonder how easy you find it to switch off after a job, especially the intense ones. You know, we were just talking about how that inhabiting the role of Tommy Shelby. Most of your work is intense these days, you know, with big stories. You're attracted to that kind of material. How easy is it to switch lanes and disappear into normal life again?
It's difficult, but I have a very, very understanding family. They kind of know when I'm re-emerging, you know, and I stop walking like the character, you know, and I know I'm just re-emerging. But you're neither like the character or the civilian. You're sort of just figuring it out.
So you're in a like a liminal space
exactly.
for a while.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's a bit odd for a while, but it's nothing like people love to make it like this big methody thing. For me, it's not. It's just trying to figure out what to do with my time.
And I wonder what having that family support, you know, you've got your wife and your boys. I wonder what that's allowed you to do, whether that's given you more freedom.
It's been crucial, honestly. I don't think I could have done any of the things that we talked about without having them. I've been with my wife for 28 years now, and it's been the most important thing for me, you know, just and then having those kids and raising them. I think because this sort of ancillary aspect of being an actor is quite challenging to me.
The fame bit,
all of that stuff.
The noise around it.
Exactly, yeah, the kind of noise stuff. To have a really secure solid base is important. You know, mm-hmm. It's been really important for me. You have to have that safe place. I think I certainly do, where it's just like an island of comfort and ease.
Well, you said that, you know, home and family is one kind of island for you. I'm afraid I'm about to send you off to another.
Oh,
of
yes,
course.
You are.
How will you prepare yourself for the experience of the desert island? I know you quite like your own company. You're good on your own.
I'm not bad. I'm getting better as I get older. I used to be terrible when I was a youngster. I really could not stand being on my own for more than a few hours. But I'm getting better as I get older. I think I'll be all right, you know.
And what about switching off? How good are you at relaxing?
Not great, honestly. Yeah, it's something I struggle with.
Listeners might have heard you reading a story on one of those meditation apps that's out there.
Oh, yeah.
I think your voice is there to soothe people to sleep.
I know. Someone came up to me recently and said that his wife listened to that while she was giving birth, which was quite awkward.
Isn't it? You're reading a very boring story about train travel.
It's like so dull. It's just me talking about being on a train rolling across Ireland. But then I think that's the point of it.
It's time for your next piece of music. What have you got for us?
There's an amazing amount of great music coming out of Ireland at the moment. And there was so much to choose from. But one of my favourite albums of last year was by an artist called Lisa O'Neill. And I thought I should play some of Lisa's music. And this is called If I Was a Painter.
If I was a painter with colours no end, I'd paint the whole thing simply again, where everything runs into everything.
Lisa O'Neill and If I Was a Painter. So, Cillian Murphy, it's time for me to send you away to the island. I'm going to give you the books to take with you, the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and you can select a book of your own to take. What would you like?
This is a really pretentious choice.
Okay.
So just to
get that out there.
Yes.
To begin with.
I have the complete works of Samuel Beckett at home, and it has a beautiful, beautiful portrait of him looking with his sort of very stern and beautiful face, looking down at me because I have not taken it down and read it. And he's one of my favorite writers. And it's such a body of work. It's all of it.
So this is the dramatic works and includes the novels as well?
Everything.
Okay.
Everything. And I know I need to read it all, and I will. And this would be the perfect opportunity to start at the start and the end at the end.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You can have that. I quite like the idea of you having him on the island to just keep you right.
It would be nice.
He could be a companion.
Yeah, with that beautiful portrait, yeah, looking at me, I'd put him up on a rock.
Absolutely. You can also have a luxury item. What will that be?
I mean, I'd take a guitar if I could.
Do you still play?
I mess around. Don't play as much as I should, but that would keep me going. If I could be creative in some way, you know, just, I think I'd get very agitated if I couldn't make something, you know.
And finally, which track of the eight that you shared with us today would you save from the waves first if you needed to?
This has been really, really hard, but I think it would have to be the Beatles, because I think the sentiment of that song would keep me going throughout, and it's quite jolly. I think I'll need a bit of a G up.
Cillian Murphy, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thanks, Lauren. It's a pleasure.
Hello. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Cillian. I'm sure Samuel Beckett will keep him busy on the island. We've cast away many actors, including Samantha Morton, Wendell Pierce and Anne-Marie Duff. Cillian's director colleagues Christopher Nolan and Ken Loach are in our back catalogue too. You can find these episodes in our Desert Island Discs programme archive and through BBC Sounds. The studio manager for today's programme was Jackie Marjoram. The assistant producer was Christine Pavlovsky, and the producer was Paula McGinley. The series editor is John Gowdy. Next time, my guest will be the volcanologist, Clive Oppenheimer. I do hope you'll join us.
Hold up. On This Cultural Life from BBC Radio 4, leading artists and performers reveal their creative inspirations.
I saw something that was so beyond what I was being taught at school.
Discuss their best-known work.
I do get messages all the time saying this is our life. The Handmaid's Tale is already here.
And reflect on their own cultural lives.
Rock stars need to be simply drawn. They can't be too complex.
Join me, John Wilson, and my guests, including Nick Cave, Stephen Fry, Margaret Atwood, Florence Pugh, Paul McCartney, and Whoopi Goldberg.
I always knew I was going to be a character actor. I'd never thought I was going to be a famous movie person.
This Cultural Life. Listen on BBC Sounds.